I just want to introduce this event. We're very proud of having with us an very, very interesting international artist, Lorna Simpson, who doesn't come to London very often, as we said today. And we are very happy to have this opportunity to hear her talk about her practice in conversation with Alison Green, who is a regular contributor of Art Monthly. Patricia will talk a little bit more in detail about the program we're doing with Art Monthly, which consists basically of once a month conversations between artists and writers. And we will then let the conversation start, at the end of which we will have a questions and answers. So please wait for the microphone to come to you before you ask your question, because we are recording this event on video. And also, please switch your mobile phones off. Thank you very much, and enjoy the event. Patricia.
Thank you, Gabriella. This is the second series of Talking Art collaborations with Tate Modern. And as Gabriella said, we're very proud to have Lorna Simpson with us today, talking to Alison Green, our very valued contributor. She's also teaches art history at Central St. Martin's, the University of the Arts. And you will find on your seats a special subscription offer and news about the next in the series, which is Anri Sala. So I hope we'll see you then. Lorna was actually born the same year, I won't say when, as Glenn Ligon, who was also the subject of a conversation we had here. Some of you may have come to that. So it was obviously a very good year. And I'm sure you know Glenn quite well. Lorna started out as a documentary photographer, and some of those concerns are continue in her practice as an artist. She's tackled issues of race, gender, and sex, and in mixed media, although beginning as a photographer. She had a wonderful Whitney retrospective in 2007, which sadly didn't come to this country. And she represented the US in the Venice Biennale in 1997. Holland Cotter, quoting actually Okwe Inweza, said of all her work in the early years, which was image text is the generic term, but that doesn't really cover the way in which Lorna dealt with images and words. He said very perceptively, fundamentally, that work was also audiovisual. And then it transmigrated into video and film, which seemed retrospectively a very logical development. So there's much for us to catch up on today, because we haven't seen enough of Lorna's work, and I hope we will in future. Thank you both very much.
Just by way of introduction, as far as to the audience, as far as what we're how this is going to be structured, is we're starting with some very recent work, which isn't film and video or strictly text image photography, and then we're going to go back to the 1980s and go through some text image works, and then do some.
Well, it's a relief not to go chronologically.
Right, we're breaking with strict chronology, so and we're going to sort of reference the work that's behind us, and I thought that was important. We thought that was important since there may be not complete familiarity with Lorna's work in the audience. So this most recent work, significantly, Lorna turned to drawing, and I hoped you would start by talking about that and what motivated you.
Yeah, it's interesting as an artist in terms of the scope of my work, in terms of practice and process, that I've gone through different mediums, and I think there are points where I challenge myself. And in working on a project called The Institute, which was a kind of assembly of found images that I created a video, in which I used found footage to create a video, at the end of the project, and having finished editing it, I realized, wow, these would make really interesting drawings, which were photograph or kind of very stylized filmic portraits, kind of done in Technicolor, done in the 50s, and very starkly done in kind of having a very plain background with these actresses and individuals who were part of an institution. And they were very stylized in terms of the way that they were dressed and the way that they looked, so that you could have this distinction of class between kind of working class or middle class and kind of upper middle class. And in looking at these images at the end of my project, I was like, wow, as you know, what to do with this piece in terms of maybe still images or how to translate something about the way the camera was capturing the individuals portrayed in the film. And I just thought drawing, but then it became this really weird position of I don't draw. So I just decided, not with any intention towards showing and not with any intention that it would become something, but just started kind of playing with materials to figure out how might I attack this. And they actually turned out not so bad, which has kind of brought me to then doing other projects that involve drawing at the same time of making video and other sorts of works.
So can you talk about something like, well, there's the sort of use of the repeated image, but also maybe most notably the fact that every face is turned away.
Right, which kind of refers to, in terms of the positioning of the head, to the earlier work that I made that I didn't have. It's kind of refusal of giving the viewer a complete view of the subject and trying to supplant that with other information or other ways of looking at portraiture or looking at photography. So it seemed, even in my mind, I mean, I was drawn to more a three-quarter kind of looking away from the viewer. View in the drawings and kind of harkens back to the older work.
Should we move on to another image?
Sure.
Okay. Could we? Right. Okay. That's. Oh, another set of. This is a piece called Heads, and it's from.
Well, yeah, it's like a series. I guess I had a show in New York a few months ago that was like almost maybe 100 drawings of these heads. And in some ways, it's a simplicity in terms of process. It's all these heads kind of done in pencil and ink, basically.
So was the face the same, and then you were playing with the...
The face kind of the same. Hair. I mean, the positioning would kind of change, but the same sort of positioning of the head to the body, and then these hairstyles or kind of amorphous shapes then become the signature of personality from one to another.
And we're going to get back to something on hair a little bit later in an earlier piece called Wigs. It'll be an issue that would be drawn out. Maybe if we could go forward to the next one, Photo Booth. So what I was interested in this one particularly because it had to do with appropriating an archive, and certain strategies resonate with other ways that Lorna's approached work. But maybe you could speak about the history of this archive and the decision about how you used it, because these are photo booth images plus small ink drawings.
Yeah, I always have had an interest and a desire for photography, and I find it interesting, not only kind of what the photographs declare or kind of how we might read them, but also kind of a viewer's desire in relationship to those images. And with the photo booths, which is the box that you sit in to have your portrait, it's really a self-portrait. And all these images that I had found were from maybe the 20s up until about the 60s. And what's uncanny about them is the posing that occurs, because you're really posing in front of a mirror in order to have this image taken. So it's a very direct gaze, but it's also one that is intentional to create a particular kind of position or facial expression to evoke something, as opposed to just having your photograph taken by a photographer. So all of the portraits are quite intense in terms of their gaze, kind of back to the viewer.
Can I stop you for a second and ask if you'd put the image one more forward, because there's some details so that we could see some of the faces.
So as a work, I think there should be a detailed image.
Yeah, there we go.
Switch to. I mean, each one, they're like miniature bronze frames, in a sense. But the piece kind of just, as you experience it, which I do like in many of the different works that span different genres, is this relationship of scale. Because on the wall, there are kind of these really small little squares that seem kind of dispersed on the wall. But as you kind of come closer to them, it becomes these very miniature, intense portraits. And the drawings, or the ink kind of stains that go with it, are to me, like the back of a photograph, if you rip it out of an album and it has part of the black paper that is either left, or the way photographs deteriorate in terms of their chemicals and stains are kind of created over the course of time. Mm-hmm. So it's to mimic or kind of as surrogates of images that aren't there, or kind of thinking of them just in terms of the quality of the way that photographic images deteriorate.
Yeah. Yeah. So these are really interesting to me because they were essentially sort of appropriated or collections of images of labeled as kind of groups of black men, photo booth images of black men. Mm-hmm. And so there are all sorts of issues that emerge there, as Lorna was saying, about that the sort of relationship between the person posing, because it's done in a photo booth, is not to a photographer but to a mirror, mm-hmm. Because the mirror is part of the structure of the photo booth. And I was thinking also that it's the figure in that relationship too is the intended audience, because in a way when you go into a photo booth, probably most of the time it's because that picture is for a purpose,
right,
it's for an
for
audience
someone.
Or someone, and it's
or a memento,
or a memento, yeah. And in some cases, that might be something like a driver's license, or it could be
or to a lover, or to a family member, or distances of people moving to different cities, and just having some kind of visual, as opposed to now, but back then, a kind of visual communication of how well you are doing and how things are going.
So again, it'll be a theme that hopefully we'll return to, but in a certain sense, maybe appropriation is a strategy, or essentially a use of a text or an image that comes from someplace out there in the world already. Mm-hmm. But in this case, the archive, it seems interesting to me, the idea that all of these pictures, in a certain sense, are just the point on a iceberg of a much larger story.
Well, also, I mean, I think a lot of the images also come during a time of Jim Crow laws, which is a kind of segregation laws in the United States. Mm. So it's also a portraiture of, during a particular time in American history, but also individuals who are leaving the South and going north, and there's this kind of necessity to show that you are safe, or to show that you are doing well, having kind of left what was home.
Yeah. Is there another image of these? There you go. And it turned out that not all of them were of men, even though.
True. I mean, in collecting them, either in kind of thrift stores or flea markets, people hand you kind of, they have for sale kind of these groups of photographs of all kinds. I mean, a big mixture. But it's funny because you do experience then the way people categorize and kind of interpret these photographs themselves. So I was given a bunch of portraits of men, and like, yes, they're all men, and then, but looking through them, I realized, no, they're not all men. So again, this kind of idea of gender and the way that gender plays and is read within the specter of race was apparent just in my dealings of trying to accumulate these sorts of images and buy them.
Yeah. So this sort of draws out one of the themes, in a way, one of the kind of issues that Lorna seems to be working with about, how the sort of the social body is defined through something like photography, mm-hmm. Through something like photography or something like the archive or any kind of bureaucratic system that organizes and categorizes and where those, where representation sort of becomes inadequate
or falls apart,
yeah. Or misrepresents, mm-hmm. or subjugates.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We move to the next one. Yes, and these are really interesting to me. So this drawing, mm-hmm. These are a series of works made after the invasion of Iraq.
Oh, yeah. Well,
yeah, obviously.
Done this, I guess, last year.
Okay, yeah. Last year. Yeah, and can you talk about these?
In terms of the news and kind of reading, I guess, about people who are then detained, quote-unquote detained, for interrogation and kind of the way that information is conveyed in media, mm-hmm. as to who that is, how they're detained, mm-hmm. the way that they're presented, so that kind of within American law in terms of people who are either arrested or quote-unquote detained. You know, there's certain rights that you have as individuals, which has been suspended, certainly during this time. But that this is a kind of a Iraqi businessman who's been detained and is being held for interrogation, but certainly by American soldiers. But in the United States, of course, you wouldn't have a businessman kind of blindfolded. And so there's a kind of acceptance of what we see as kind of a norm.
Because this is an image that was that appeared in the New York Times.
Yeah. And it assumes a certain level of treatment, but also the suspect and the danger of that suspect and how they are presented. So although he is blindfolded and handcuffed, I mean, his name, who he is, and everything is published as part of the caption, so then who is he being blindfolded from becomes an interesting prospect. But it's more about the assumption of American public in terms of what you accept as responsible interrogation practices or holding of detaining individuals during a time of war. So a lot of the images were, which were interesting, I kind of did a bit of research about interrogation rooms, and they're kind of these rooms that are either places that are, you know, gymnasiums, bathhouses, derelict buildings that are then just temporarily created to interrogate or torture, or they're these instant plywood buildings that are made by the military that are kind of these instant structures as well that are
can be moved and reset up
and taken
wherever
apart
they're needed
very easily.
Or disappeared.
Exactly.
So it's interesting because in a way you could come back at this from an angle of documentary, because in a certain sense the original image is a documentary image, but the way you are involved in a kind of representation of that through a different medium, towards, you know, trying to, you know, reorient our vision or reconstruct our vision about what that is. Because part of what photojournalism does is, well, it leads us to a particular interpretation of something, but it also normalizes the looking at something like, you know, it doesn't, you know, I was thinking about that whole history of photography in terms of being, being evidence, being a kind of problematic evidence. So the photograph doesn't actually prove anything, but with the caption, with the context of being presented in a newspaper, it's there as
And it kind of also develops a kind of apathy of those who are, you know, of kind of taking in all that information all the time. Yes. It does go kind of unquestioned after a certain point, after a barrage, what you're actually looking at and what you assume to be appropriate or inappropriate in what you're looking at, because it becomes so part of one's daily existence.
Was this after the Abu Ghraib photographs?
Yes, this is after
well
that
after.
As well.
Yes, if this was last year.
Yeah.
Because there was something very strange about seeing those for the first time. I still have this memory of seeing those images for the first time and almost very much not understanding how horrible they were at first, because in some respects they looked they look like pranks at first. That's how I read them, and it I mean, it's sort of evidence of how, because images are part of our everyday consumption in a certain sense, we misread them a lot of the time.
But it's also, I mean, interesting with that. That's a situation of soldiers coping with their day-to-day and kind of having no boundaries in terms of how they accomplish what they need to accomplish. So kind of living within that hell, you know, the response is to create a little side hell. But I think the intention of those photographs, they were never going to be released. I mean, it was kind of as this way of reaching out to people who are back home and creating this kind of levity, quote-unquote levity, to what they experience every day. So it's not so much I'm giving an excuse to that, but the photographic evidence or trophy-like evidence of those images really speak to kind of talking about what their day-to-day was and what they were capable of on a day-to-day level.
Yeah. So what do you think these achieved by being by the drawing, or what was the mediation of the drawing for you?
It's funny. I mean, I think when I look at them, and there was only one image with an individual in it. The rest of them are just rooms. So it's very hard to make out what they are in the drawings. And I mean, maybe they have like, you know, there's a little water board, or they're kind of metal handcuffed, embedded in cement devices and stuff. But you don't really see, you have to kind of look and know what those things are in the photograph.
Sort of almost
so more. They kind of do play on the kind of ordinariness of the way that those images become very familiar, but at the same time, they become very foreign very quickly when you, if placed just without any explanation. Mm-hmm. I think those details start to stand out more as a sign of kind of how unusual they are. Right. So, they, you know, they're set up in, you have a nice room, they're interrogation rooms that are maybe a little bit more cushy. But, you know, like you'll look on the floor and there are places for handcuffs to be chained to the, within the structure of the floor. Yeah. So there are little subtle things within each image that suggests physical detainment or torture.
So it's sort of an unraveling of towards that sort of the information, that extra information you need. I sort of want to come back to this later, but it may make more sense after we've talked about more of your work. But it seems significant to me that this wasn't, the body in this particular image wasn't of an African American. There are some non-African Americans that appear in some of the videos, but because often your work is spoken about as dealing with issues of race in America, I thought it was interesting that this sort of seems to spread out of that context, move out of that context. Obviously, it's deeply, it has to do with American
policy,
you know, policy for sure, so it's very relevant. But maybe that's something to return to. If we could go, I hope that, yes, excellent. So this is back, going back to an early, very iconic work of Lorna's from
1986.
Yeah. And the title of it is Water Bearer. And in a way, it could serve to orient us towards sort of Lorna's particular use of text and image in the 1980s and the relationship, say, the relationship that she was setting up between text and image, and maybe also the way you were using photography as a move away from this. Patricia mentioned that, you know, Lorna had sort of started out as a documentary photographer, but made a break with that and started to pursue photography in a particular way and towards particular purposes that were quite different from documentary.
Well, I think, I have to say, in terms of my education, probably experimental film had a lot to do with looking at the way that I made these kinds of images, which was kind of taking away the background of the images completely, turning the gaze away from the viewer, having the viewer, rather than giving information about facial expression or emotional details or personality trait in terms of the reading of the images, to give the viewer something else to think about. So kind of eliminating all of those desired aspects of the way that we read photography to letting the text talk about something else. Because I think my frustration with documentary photography is that you kind of look at it, you at that time, and that was like maybe late 70s, early 80s, is that you'd look at it and you kind of use the same tools to read each photograph, regardless of photographer, regardless of subject. And in some ways, wanted to kind of take away those tools or leave those tools a little bit for the viewer as being inadequate, or that the viewer's desires about what they should expect from a photograph would be slightly circumvented and not given what they want. So with this kind of image, which is kind of a kind of 10 years worth of work that kind of had this sort of structure of the figure back turned and text. And in particular, this text, which is kind of a bit more poetic and speaks about memory and then memories that are denied or not accounted for or recognized, is kind of memory, not in a nostalgic way, but more in terms of the way, the consequences of one's memory and kind of what situations that create socially were more important to me than a kind of nostalgic way of thinking about memory and individuals in time. So this is kind of an example where the work was more, I would say, poetic. But then again, the text and other works were created kind of in a more concrete poetry, where lists of things start an accumulation of list or alliteration, creating a sense of a particular time or story. So within my relationship to text, there was a lot of back and forth with playing with words and playing with language and double meanings as well.
Anyway, this there's something interesting about the text. Well, both the image and the text, in the sense that, that you said you sort of stripped away a lot of information out of the image. So it's in a kind of, you know, apparently neutral space. And I'm sort of interested in this, these white.
Well, it's a constructed
white,
image.
It's a constructed image. Yeah. Okay, and these white dresses that this. Mm-hmm. And the next image that we'll show you, it seems, it's like, is it an undergarment? Is it a shift that somebody who's been institutionalized is made to wear? So it's, she's been, both in the text and in the image, she's been sort of pulled out of time or pulled out of a sort of specific place that, say, the documentary image would give you, would be a particular social construct. But that isn't to say that this lacks a politics. I think it very much has a politics. So in a certain sense, it's playing with both maybe an aesthetic aspect or what you gain from those and a process of aestheticizing an image. And it was, I thought also there was in the text that sort of directs you towards a certain interpretation of what we're supposed to be looking at. I thought it's about somebody sort of, it's almost a convergence almost like a love situation. I intuited something, but then absolutely converted into this legal situation that can't kind of accommodate whatever experience she's had. So she's witnessed something. But similar, and that was a connection I made to the interrogation rooms, in a certain sense of the way, say, memory.
Or the silencing of this memory.
Or the direction of certain words towards an outcome that has a different agenda probably attached to it.
Which I didn't see that connection when we spoke before. I was like, oh, really? I didn't think about those connections back to the earlier work.
Yeah.
But that is true.
Yeah, that's true. And maybe it's important to mention here, too, sort of a conceptual strategy of using photography and text in a certain way.
True.
That's different from fine art photography or the
documentary. Well, it's funny. I mean, in going to art school and kind of growing up on the East Coast and then going to graduate school on the West Coast in California, there are two schools of thought. I mean, kind of New York at that time, where the East Coast was much more photography in its kind of quote-unquote purest form or its commercial application, and kind of California was all about kind of conceptual performance art in that sense. So I think I kind of melded somewhat the two in terms of my relationship to the work. But again, kind of even just looking at film and looking at French New Wave film from the 60s and or late 50s, early 60s, and kind of all the different ways to kind of break the bounds of film in terms of the way that you kind of interpret sound and think about linear storyline and all of that, really kind of, I wouldn't say, you know, my work kind of demonstrates that, but certainly I found that fascinating during the time that I was in undergraduate. So it's really kind of dismantling all these different aspects of photography that you assume should operate in one particular way, but not taking those aspects for granted.
Right. So the text directs us towards a different idea of narrative that maybe comes from film or comes from a conceptual strategy rather than one that finds it all in the image itself, a still of a narrative. So in this one as well, we have this, Lorna mentioned already, but this idea that the face in many of these works from the series, or all of the works from the series, the face is either cropped or turned away, which denies that sense of being able to, you know, objectify or to
individualize
that the figure that's in the photograph, the sort of level of abstraction that's going on, or level of, well, it's both a level of abstraction, I tried to say before, it was an aestheticization, which I mean in a particular way, but it's also about disrupting certain ways in which photography communicates, or,
sure.
you know, as it ordinarily conventionally communicates. Yeah, there was one quote I read. So in an early text about Lorna's work, the writer Bell Hooks talked about this work as countering the way African Americans are normally presented photographically,
mm-hmm.
sort of countering both kind of racist and sexist stereotypes.
Yeah.
And she really read this is like the first positive image of a black woman she'd see.